So, I mean, you've kind of touched on what kind of changes have come in the last 30 or 50 years. So, what changes do you see the shift from agriculture to land development creating in culture and, well, I say culture, but in New Mexico?
Well, let's take a couple of examples. Let's take water. We're facing water crisis of catastrophic proportions in the 21st century, all over the world. It's going to hit hardest and fastest in the arid regions, and the people who are going to experience it most extremely soonest, of course, are the poor people. You already see this along the border, where you have people living in colonias where their water is hauled in trucks and stored in barrels. You cross from Juarez, from El Paso into Juarez, and the water situation is radically different. One of the things that the real estate escalation and urbanization and development has done is not only consumed land, but even more important, water, and promoted the severing of water rights from agricultural land so that people can transfer. It used to be that if you had irrigated land, the land and the water went together and people didn't think about separating them. But once you think of them as commodities that can be quantified and have monetary value attached to them, that if you have a piece of irrigated land and your main objective is to turn it into cash and as much as possible, then what you want to do is to sell them separately, because the price in water rights, the market of water rights, is escalating in order to grow Albuquerque, Rio Rancho, the Mesa del Sol development, Intel, resorts, Towski Valley. You need more water. And since all the surface water in New Mexico is already allocated, there's no new water coming in except for the San Juan Chama Diversion Project, which is what Albuquerque, Santa Fe, all the growth that's going to take place in the corridor is counting on that water, the leasing of water that's actually from the Colorado River, which is an interesting story since the Colorado doesn't even flow through New Mexico. But if you're, where the other place that people are looking to get water from is from agriculture. They say, oh, some 70-some percent of the water, surface water in New Mexico, is used for agriculture, and people in cities, as well as the state engineer of New Mexico and developers of all kinds, very comfortably assume that that water is going to come from agriculture because they consider agriculture inefficient and sort of, you know, unnecessary. If you take a piece of irrigated land and you sell the water rights separately, that means that that piece of land will forever be dry. It can never again be used for agricultural purposes. There's only certain kinds of development that you can use it for, just like paving it over with cement. It forecloses a more diverse use of it as a resource. You take that water off of a ditch, not only are you removing the amount of water from the ditch, but you're removing the participation in the system. The parciante is no longer a parciante. So that means that family no longer sends someone in the spring to help clean the ditch. It's a loss of one link in the chain of interconnection in the community. So it has not only the result or the consequence of removing a certain quantity of water from the system and leaving forever dry that piece of land, but it removes that commitment, that involvement, that labor, that investment in the collectivity of the system. So if you've got an acequia association and maybe, you know, 15 ditches in a community off of the acequia madre, there comes a point at which if you've lost so many water rights and you've lost so many parciantes, there's probably a threshold beyond which it becomes impossible to maintain the whole. So a whole social fabric, a whole cultural community is lost when so many water rights go. So that would be one example of how these changes are affecting local communities and people's sense of connection and of who they are. I mean, you have in northern New Mexico Hispanos who are a place-based people and a kinship-based people. They're also now an urbanizing people, and they're in cities as well. I don't want to promote the idea that there's still sort of these untouched enclaves of people who've never left their communities, because I don't think you have that anymore after World War II. But leaving your community and moving to Los Angeles doesn't necessarily mean you forget or that you don't want to go back. You may or may not have a place to go back to. It may or may not be possible to do that. And of course, the Native Americans are place-based, land-based peoples. I think there are a lot of similarities, even though Pueblo peoples and Hispanos are often pitted off against each other by legal processes or even in people's imaginations. I think they share a lot of values, and they certainly share a bittersweet history of interconnection. So I don't know, does that answer?
Yeah. And just to touch on that, because you're probably the fourth or fifth person that I've spoken with who has mentioned the way that people have pitted the Indio Espanol and the Native American at one another. And usually people say that the other people who have said that it was the Anglos who pit the two together, pit against each other. Where does that come from? Because I
think there are a lot of different sources for that. One would be federal policy. Just the way in which the American system, once it incorporated this part of Mexico into the United States, dealt differently with Indians than it did with Mexicans. And it also differentiated among Indians. And one of the problems for them was, would Pueblo Indians be considered tribes, or would they be considered a different kind of more agricultural, more, quote, civilized Native American? So there was a lot of debate as to how the Pueblos themselves would be regarded. But in the long run, what one of the great differences was that Indians, including the Pueblos, took on a particular status in the American system. They became wards of the federal government, which assumed trust status for Native Americans, which meant that their land and their water was inalienable. Of course, you could say, well, who really owns it, the federal government or the tribes themselves? And I think the discourse of sovereignty has intensified. And that's even been more, I think, reinforced by the coming of gaming, and has given the Pueblos, as well as other Native American groups, a kind of economic power that can translate into political power that they didn't have before. But Mexican Americans, even though the terms of the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo promised them protection of their land and water, had no such collective status. They were just regular citizens, even though, of course, the history of discrimination against Mexican Americans says that even though legally they had a certain status, they nevertheless had second-class status as citizens. And there's a whole long history of that, and the Chicano movement, I think, gave voice to that, although there were plenty of organizations and activists that were working in behalf of their Mexican-American communities long before the Chicano movement came along, and often it was labor movements that was part of that. So just the way that the federal government has dealt differently with Indians and Mexicans has enormous repercussions for policy, and particularly for land and water rights ownership. Another was the coming of the artists and tourism, which glorified and romanticized the Indian and projected onto the Indian all of these romantic notions that, you know, had transformed from seeing the Indian as a savage that had to be exterminated with the pushing west of the United States frontier to the noble savage that then became, you know, what artists painted, and and thought about in these most romantic terms, Mexicans were always regarded basically very differently, and they had none of the kind of elevated spiritual or aesthetic status that Europe Americans imagined Indians had. They were seen basically as backward, dirty greasers who were cheap labor. And I think the ways in which the economies have used different people is reflected in how they were seen symbolically. So if you just look at the art of the art colony, and up until fairly recently, just look at the ways in which Indians are portrayed and the ways in which Mexicans were portrayed, which was far less were they portrayed. Almost always they were portrayed in context of doing manual labor, whereas the Indians were portrayed as, you know, in this pristine natural form as warriors or as at ritual. And this reflects sort of the racialization, the different racialization of these peoples. And so there was an anthropologist named Jim Bodine, John Bodine, who I think was part Taos, who wrote a little paper in the 1960s called The Triethnic Trap of Taos. And he talked about how the Indian was idealized and romanticized and also protected by federal policy, which isn't to in any way dismiss the ways in which Indians have been discriminated against and the kinds of poverty to which they've been subject, and the fact that even though they've been the key symbols and their pueblos, particularly Taos, sort of the key attractions for tourism, they haven't necessarily always been the major beneficiaries of a tourist economy. That may be changing to some extent now, but you know, they were not the primary beneficiaries. The developers were. Whereas the Mexican was not seen as having a culture or a language or traditions that were worth saving, worth sort of crusading to save. You have generations of Anglo anthropologists, artists, writers, social activists, progressives, who took up the cause of the American Indian and lobbied and gave money and supported it. The Blue Lake case being an example. But you never had that happening, or rarely did you have that same kind of movement and mobilization of resources to protect the interests or the land holdings or the water holdings of Mexican Americans. So it was a really, and the triethnic trap that Bodine talks about was sort of the way in which Mexican and Indians were differently regarded, that how they were differently treated by federal policy, state policy, but also the Mexican experience of having been conquered and having lost status with Americanization and the kind of resentment that that created. Whereas Mexican landholdings were not protected, Indian landholdings were under the American system. So there's this whole layer of romantic tourist-driven idealization and differentiation between Mexicans and Indians. Also, another policy that took place is that in the early American era, people who were mestizo, who were mixed, and I should say that pretty much everybody is. I mean, we have this myth that, you know, Indians are somehow pure. Mexicans, I think part of the way, part of the denigration of Mexicans is that by definition they're not pure, but the whole notion that the Spaniard, the Spanish American, was pure, that you've got these pure ethnic groups, these pure racial groups. Some people were forced to choose by federal policy. Either you're an Indian or you're a Mexican, and in either way, you took some hits. I mean, obviously, you know, Indians were subject to forced assimilation policies, BIA boarding schools, all kinds of things. So it's not that, I'm not saying that, you know, Native Americans didn't suffer terribly from federal policies, but I'm also talking about sort of the ways in which federal policy and the culture of tourism very differently portrayed these groups. So it often became that advocates of Indian causes saw the Mexicans as the enemy, or as, and I've heard more than once people say, well, they took away the Indians' land. Why are they griping about losing their land? As if somehow policies that hurt them are justified by the fact that the Spanish conquered the Indians. So there's a notion of very different values of language and culture. And I think that the anti-Mexican attitude goes back to the black legend about the Spanish character, which starts with England, right? But the whole history of Anglo-American attitudes toward Mexico change as the U.S. relationship to Mexico changes, and people have traced that through time. And of course today, with immigration issues being so important, there's again a sort of devaluing of the Mexican. So it's got different historical periods to it. Anthropologists have been much more interested in the study of Indian culture than Mexican culture. Until, I think, relatively recently, with some important exceptions, Mexican Americans were what sociologists studied because they needed to deal with the Mexican problem. But there was a sense that the culture and the people were not as interesting, not as valuable. And that's changing now, I think, as notions of culture are changing. I mean, I think that, you know, so-called Anglo culture is just as interesting and worthy of anthropological study as anything else, you know, whether it's Native American or New Guinea or whatever. But there's always this notion that somehow the colored other has got more culture and more ethnicity, and that that's what we need to paint or that's what we need to study, to the exclusion of other things that are equally interesting or important or significant from an anthropological point of view.